Welcome to the Wellbeing Ignites Well-Doing podcast, produced by OOT Social Health, where the focus is on exploring the essential elements that drive organizational success, human-centric leadership. Hosted by Adjoa Boahidi, principal of AKB Talent Edge.
Wellbeing Ignites Well-Doing podcast. My name is Tiagi Delanerol, and I'm your host today. I'm joined by Phil Kirshner, founder and principal consultant at PK Consulting. Today, we're going to be speaking about designing workplaces for human potential, the future of work in the age of AI. We'll be exploring Phil's expertise in workplace strategy, employee experience, and organizational effectiveness in an era where AI is reshaping our work. This episode will focus on how AI and workplace design can elevate human potential, create inclusive and high-performing work environments, and really redefine the role of physical and digital spaces. Now, Phil is a visionary leader and global thought leader on the future of work, workplace transformation, and human-centric design. As the founder of PK Consulting, he advises organizations on how to redesign work and improve employee experience in a rapidly evolving world. With over 20 years of experience spanning McKinsey & Company, WeWork, and JLL, Phil has worked with real top real estate and talent executives to develop data-driven, dynamic, and responsive work environments that foster collaboration, engagement, and well-being. Welcome, Phil. It's so nice to have you.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. Well, at the Employee Wellbeing Council, we are all about being human-centric. So we're going to center around you to start the podcast. And we're going to begin with two Proust-inspired questions. The very first question is, which talent would you most like to have?
I think given my exposure to the design and workplace world, having come to it from the like digital spreadsheets-oriented background that I have, I'm immensely jealous of people who can draw like really well in ways that can communicate stories other than just boxes and lines. So maybe I wish I could sketch with realism in a way that some of my colleagues and friends can.
Okay. Well, you've been amongst a lot of architects, I'm sure, too, right? Like folks that architect and also design and do layouts. So I suppose, yeah, that would make a lot of sense, right? The drawing piece. I've heard all sorts of, interesting talents leaders would love to have, right? One is definitely singing. I've heard singing a lot. But drawing, you know what? I think this might be the first time I'm here to draw.
Drawing well.
I had a former boss who would threaten that you'd have to sing if you were late to a meeting or coming back to a meeting. Maybe that scared me from ever wanting that to be a talent that I also don't have.
There you go. All right. Well, the next question is an interesting one. So if you were to die and come back as a person or thing, what would it be?
I don't know what this world needs right now, but it's some sense of leadership that is more balanced and human and not so quick to make snap decisions that are hurtful to different populations. So I don't know who that person would be, but if there was a chance to come back as someone who would start chipping away at just how like binary society feels right now, maybe some of the great leaders of the past. That'd be really great and useful for everybody, I think. I don't know who it would be, but we need it so desperately.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. You know, it seems like we're in a really awkward time in history, right?
We are.
It very much feels that way.
Very polarizing, right. I think so.
It is very polarizing. That's a great word to describe what's taking place right now. So we're going to get into a little bit of your background, right? The workplace as an operating system for human potential. Now, you've spoken about creating an operating system for work that uplifts human potential. What does that mean and how do organizations achieve it?
Sure. So my background's in technology, so I think of things in those kinds of metaphors, apps and operating systems and architectures. And over the last couple of years in particular, this post-COVID desire to better understand the influence that choices in our time and location and the tools that we use have on our business and talent outcomes, I found myself saying we need, but do not often have in large companies, a true operating system for work. By which I mean, today, if you ask what seems like a relatively straightforward question for some company, what types of spaces in our portfolio are most liked or most used by senior level female leaders who are high performing in the last year? And that kind of analysis, it's not complicated. It's not like commodities, and high frequency trading and those kind of algorithms. An intern could do it if given all the data, on a few spreadsheets. But the groups who own that information, groups like HR, who have if somebody's gender or somebody's performance ratings, groups like real estate who have the built environment data, and in groups like IT who may be able to tell how or when something is utilized, have even been trained over the years to protect what they have internally. It's like their source of value. So they don't make it very easy to share with each other, much less to aggregate and analyze together. So when I say operating system work, even just the base layer is the data that represents the fingerprints for your organization of how and where and why people are doing things, how projects are performing, who they are, what the outcomes are internally and externally, so that we can even begin to interrogate and iterate and learn from choices that we're making, following trends, again, since you think about well-being, like in the quantified self in our human lives, right? We wear watches and rings and necklaces and bands and all sorts of stuff that say, when you do this, then that happens. You go out really late, you have a lot of drinks, you don't sleep so great. We need the organizational version of that, and we're still very far away, I'm afraid.
Wow. That's actually such a great piece if we had that, right? If we had that operating system. I know that in studying the work of Vivek Murthy, for example, the former U.S. Surgeon General, he spoke of not the operating system, but a framework for mental health and well-being in the workplace. And he spoke of these five different criteria. And I think that that's good. But what you're ultimately saying is having an operating system allows us to better understand the flow of data and what the outcomes would look like. So almost also analyzing what's working, right? And kind of doubling down on some of that.
Yeah, even a very simple example of my practitioner days when I was at Credit Suisse, we had very sophisticated monitoring for shared environments that I helped to build. And it just created an atmosphere with the users where they felt that something wasn't going well, like places were crowded or imbalanced, and the vibe of the environment changed unexpectedly. Mm-hmm. They could come to me and instead of saying, you did this, or why did you do this? And say, can we go to the tape, almost like in a sporting event, right, together? And I'm not saying I had all of this human capital and performance and business outcomes and everything, but we had more than they had been used to in terms of how the space was used and who was doing what, like different organizational demographics, and could sort of sit there and go back in recent time together and just try to figure out what changed. And it was very informative and completely changed the nature of the resistance in the dialogue. I'm here to make your work life better, but I'm not, I'm not literally God who orchestrates every little bit of every little day. So things are going to happen and let's talk about it.
Yeah. I really like that they felt comfortable, right? To come to you and know that you had the data to analyze and make the right decisions. So,
right. Nearly not individually identifiable data, but back to the personal life, right? We trade our privacy all the time for better experience, a better function in our personal lives. And it feels creepy in a corporate life, but that's because users tend to think that the corporate is using it for reasons that don't help them. But if you can create an environment, say, listen, I have a certain level of information about you, but I'm very transparently here to play it back to you and with you so that we can figure out together how to make tomorrow, better than yesterday was, then, you know, there's much more openness to that kind of conversation.
Yep. Yeah, as long as you're able to share that this is really to their benefit and this is how it's going to pan out.
Totally.
So in a similar vein, let's talk about how, you know, AI is influencing workplace strategy and how can organizations balance digital transformation with human-centric design?
Yeah, that's a great question. It may be a little bit related to my last point, right? When we hear digital transformation, many employees, I think, especially these days, it triggers at least some kind of a fear emotion. Are you here to change my job, take my job, challenge my identity of who I am and what I do? And, you know, digital transformation for years, you know, was associated with maybe like larger scale automation or introduction of things that had lightweight impact on my day to day. But the advent of generative AI in particular is making that term or associating that term a lot more, at least in this moment, with a threat to individuals. So maybe that makes them a bit more wary of what is being framed as digital transformation instead of a reimagination of the work. And it ultimately comes back to how you kind of structure the vision for a change like this. If you can get somebody on board with the reasons why something is broken today, whatever broken means, or help them understand who decided that something was broken, what's broken, how can you help me get behind what you are trying to change about the way things that are working today? Is it my client's experience? Is it some kind of sort of societal metric? What's going to get me invested in this project and process, not just sit back and think it's going to happen to me? Like, can I feel involved in it? That makes it inherently human-centered, right? And in particular, if that means that somebody's job is going to change and you're honest with them about that trajectory and how you're going to support them as they almost work themselves out of a job or implement something that's going to change the nature of their job, maybe it's my optimism, but I think they can be on board with it. But so much tends to be hidden and are kind of, you know, radar right now for lack of authenticity and people hiding vulnerability is very high, right? We, in the 5 years ago this week, like core COVID, all of our leaders became very human very fast. And I think the pendulum swung back a little bit now. We're hearing much more from the business side of leadership messaging, and workers feel it. You know, like you used to treat me more like a human, and now I'm back to feeling a bit like a number. So when you say digital transformation, I don't necessarily think that you have my best interest in mind.
Yep. Part of it also is very much that communication piece, right? And making sure people feel like they're on the same page, like they know what's going on and they're being heard and understood. Like, that's also part of what I'm hearing from a number of conversations that I'm having with leaders, that's really key to kind of, I guess, the adoption of transformation efforts, right? Like, it's so, the communication piece is so key. Okay, yeah. So now let's talk about what your line of work has been in the past, right? Really around helping companies become better at hybrid work. And ultimately what we want to understand is, what's the true purpose of the office today? How do you see how companies can make offices and workplaces much more engaging?
That's a great question. So broadly speaking, or just generalizing, my last 15 years or so, in part as a workplace strategist, that's really helping companies of all shapes and sizes think about the role and the impact that the built environment has on their business and their people. And prior to COVID, and still now, many companies never thought much about that, really. The office was a given. It is the box of space where we all go to do the thing that we do, which has nothing really to do with real estate for lots of companies, right? We make widgets, we do accounting, professional services, whatever it is, but we all come to this place to do that work. And they didn't think much of it. They never asked often, like, what the employees thought about those places. And what you find if you go down the route of fairly traditional workplace effectiveness studies, which means, you know, asking individuals and teams, what are the things that are important to you in your days and weeks and months, activity-wise? And how well does the thing that you sit in today support those activities? And that could be a very modern office. It could be a cubicle. It could be, you know, private office for you. It could be co-working sites. It could be your house. Wherever it is that you spend your time, does the place where you spend your time allow you to do the thing that you are supposed to do or need to do to be successful for your business and for your personal, you know, well-being and work-life balance? And in even the nicest offices prior to COVID, the answer for a lot of people was that for most of the time, most of the activities, most of the places that they sat in weren't that great. And I think that's a result of the fact that the office was always a catch-all. It doesn't mean it's a one-size-fits-all, but you can't make all places perfect for all people, all times, for everything. So it's never great at everything. It's kind of mediocre at best. And so when you say, like, what is the purpose of the office? My provocation is that most offices do not have a clearly defined purpose. If you were to sit down with the building, metaphorically speaking, and ask the building, what have you done for me lately? You're not going to get a very good answer. In, you know, in retail stores and hotels and restaurants, kind of the hospitality industry at large, those buildings have a good answer. You are supposed to help me sell my wares. And how'd you do last month, right? I sold lots of things. Great, check. But for the office, it's hard to articulate that. So I think that for companies to be successful, in particular now where employees have much higher sort of friction and a lower natural desire to spend their time going somewhere that isn't great and is now, in a way, optional, where it was not necessarily so pre-COVID. They're asking a harder question. Why should I come? And it's back to the quantified self, right? You behave a certain way. Certain things are good for you. And if a company is willing to pick and stick to 3 to 5 really distinctive purposes or sort of experiences that not just all of their places, but particular places are supposed to accelerate, then I can make that choice on a day-to-day basis, right? My things go better for me personally or professionally when I can help, you know, resolve more incidents faster. And if a company builds a service center that is designed to do that, it had better be not just designed, but sort of activated technically and through services, amenities, community events, to make that true, right? What is it that is visible to me, accessible to me, encouraging me, inspiring me when I'm in this place that helps me resolve incidents faster? And then I will make a choice, because I might say going to that box that is purpose-built for rapid, you know, client incident resolution, I can do that thing better in that box than in my house, certainly, if you've actually defined that purpose or built for it.
Yeah, that's so, like, it's really an interesting way of looking at the workplace, right? Like that physical workplace and how it can be utilized. I think, I mean, for me, when I think about the workplace, I think about it as an opportunity to connect with colleagues, right? And really engage in a different way that's meaningful.
Yeah, but that, like, on the connection point, so, you know, the 3-year run-up to COVID, I led the enterprise workplace strategy and experience team at WeWork, and I spent a lot of time touring a lot of executives through our own headquarters, not just a normal WeWork building, but the place where WeWork employees worked. And the by far the most common question and concern that we heard from them, in particular my team doing more strategic advisory projects with those clients, bringing the best of the WeWork magic at the time to them, we would say, what are you trying to sell for? And they would say, we struggle with connection and community, or social capital, in our office pre-COVID. So when everyone says, oh, COVID broke connection and community in our office, that doesn't sit with me, because I'm like, you didn't have it before. And you struggled to figure out how to create an environment where people felt that you know, psychologically safe and engaged and like open to want to meet and interact with other people, that was transparent and sort of fluid and vibrant, where your leaders were compelled to be in the open out there, like with everybody, because you know the 25-year-olds like to hang out with each other, but they also want to hang out with the boss. And so, yeah, that problem stands now. And it's a very difficult thing to curate, which is why, you know, I still believe that there's significant interest in community and hospitality oriented spaces where that comes more naturally. But it's not easy and it's not free. And any company that says, I want this office to be a high velocity social capital machine, cannot also continuously be applying pressure to their real estate colleagues who may be buried deep in the organization, telling them every day, how are you going to save me another dollar? Because those two things don't, you know, they conflict.
Yeah, absolutely. You can't have the best of both worlds in that regard, right?
Right.
So now shifting gears to something that I think leaders tend to obsess over, which is analytics, right? How do you measure productivity, engagement, and space utilization? Like, what have you seen having worked in this capacity, like reporting back to these executives?
Yeah. So look, productivity is a hard one. I think even at the company level, leaders are not getting a comfort with the output and success and effectiveness of individual teams, because those teams, you know, very often don't even have that documented. Some firms are very good with things like OKRs, and that's a great step. But I advise, like, instead of using, in particular, utilization or presence and show up rate, which is an input, as a false sense of success and productivity as an output, you have to be, back to the operating system point, looking at for any given business unit, even down to small teams, wherever your prevailing small number of outcomes and metrics, key metrics are, how are those things influenced by the patterns of your people? And it may be, you know, that they're there all the time, which is great, but that they're also spending half their time in, you know, needless administrative meetings, which takes away from their ability to focus and, you know, materially move the needle forward on their individual or group objectives. And that is also not great. So in this post-COVID world, I hear a lot of teams who are almost martyring the office or lack of people being in the office as the only potential reason why they feel that outcomes are lower, instead of trying to understand what those outcomes were, especially before COVID or now, and continuously interrogating what is the reason that they may not be the same between multiple teams doing similar things. It may not be the place, right? It may be the quality and consistency and authenticity of the mentoring and apprenticeship provided by the leaders of those teams, mm-hmm. who could be anywhere, or the consistency in the ways of working. There's so much that has to do with our individual experience and that contributes to the effectiveness of our teams. But right now, everybody's holding up this one shiny number. Like, were you here? And you weren't here, so that's got to be it. Where that absolutely is not the case. And, of course, it's very complicated to do all this analysis, but that's where I'm optimistic that, you know, AI and related sort of digital coaches will make it easier for us to even ask the question if the data is available.
Yeah. Yeah. That's true. Like, it's you need to be able to kind of understand and measure so that you can build programs that help coach the right types of behavior. But
And not assume, I've been working with a client recently that actually has, to their credit, spent a lot of time with individual business units, really trying to look at not every measure of productivity, but per group, you pick one, pick something that you can measure and that everybody understands. And let's just see how that number moves based loosely on how frequently someone's in the office. And the real trick is, even if the result says today that the people who are in either a specific amount of time or more time than less, that number is higher, not to make that a false equivalency driven by kind of proximity bias and say, aha, just because you're here more, that number is higher. But there may be something else, right? And I think that in a modern work and leadership construct, today's leaders, tomorrow's leaders have to ask the question, okay, even if it is true that there's something about them being here, I want to understand what I could be doing to possibly raise the outcome for the people who aren't here. Because that's going to make you get to the deeper problem. Is it about how I show up in the world? Is it about how we meet? Is it about the tools that we use, the access to resources that we have when we're not here? Because if you can do that and you can take the place out of the equation for the baseline business as usual output, then when you get people together, you have a higher likelihood of being able to spend that time in real life on the higher order, human to human activities, the mentoring, the training, the connection and social capital, and not all sitting in a room together, moving little tasks through your cycle.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, we spoke about this, just briefly, right? Like, we're in this age of AI right now where it's essentially optimizing so many different ways in which we, synthesize data and also really brainstorm and make key decisions. What do you think we need to look out for in this new world of work that allows us to still be human-centric from a leadership perspective?
I think we're at a really interesting moment, obviously, for AI. And for a lot of people who are not familiar with it, it's going to caught them off guard and not realize that much of the work that we do now, many of the systems we rely on, have been powered by forms of artificial intelligence and machine learning for years, just not the generative kind that has hit the market and everybody's newsfeed with ChatGPT and other large language model tools in the last 2 and a bit years. And much of the focus still is on the kind of individual productivity. I think people are playing on their own and looking for ways of doing work faster or possibly more effectively on their own. But lots of studies are still showing that they are, like, the individual employee is possibly not being transparent about how much they are or aren't using AI, that they are using tools available to them individually where their company is not caught up and provided some to them, that leaders are uncomfortable introducing and managing these constructs with teams so that they don't bring it up. And the only way, I think, to move up the kind of maturity hierarchy from, I use a co-pilot or a large language model to help maybe correct or speed up my email responses. Something very simple, right? It has to do with me. And you're doing the same thing. You're using a large language model to draft a job description or write a memo or record a meeting, something that's useful for you. But in order for it to become useful for us as a team, as a business unit, to start to materially change how we're working with each other, how we're serving the business to our clients, creating net new capacity to do or try new things, and ultimately find a better, deeper purpose, like maybe for what makes us human and what we're contributing to the process. Counterintuitively, you have to have a very human-to-human conversation about the technical capability. You almost have to sit around the table with everybody's little, like, okay, here's my list of what I'm using it for and how it's helped me or not helped me or things I'm not sure about. Maybe there are tools that do these things that I just don't know, but, like, can we all share? Because only when we share together, even on small nuclear teams, mm-hmm. with a manager that's willing to kind of facilitate that process, will we find the commonalities and be like, wait a minute, we're all doing some little micro improvement on our own instead of actually thinking about how we could do it together, mm-hmm. sustainably, how we could maybe reroute certain communications in another way such that, you know, AI is contributing to that process before any of us have to do anything manual, or create the safety to share how we're exploring new tools without a fear of when something goes wrong, that I'm immediately going to, you know, be punished for that. Someone told me recently they're in the middle of some research about how our kind of proximity to leadership affects like how much or how little we are willing to disclose the AI is being used in some process, or allow AI to do things unchecked. And, you know, an initial finding, like the closer I am to the C-suite or to executives, I am much less likely to have something go by me unchecked that came from AI, whatever that means. And I think it comes back to a human psychological safety element, right? Like, I'm worried that I'm going to get my hand slapped if something doesn't sound human enough, or there's a slight hallucination as you're learning. But that can be overcome if someone says, I believe this is the right way to go. I am willing to explore with you. I will not fault you if the machine does a weird thing mm-hmm. in these early stages. And so let's explore together. A very human way of moving us up that maturity curve.
I love especially that last piece that you just shared, right? Around let's explore together. Right. It's almost creating that sense of it's OK to be curious and to start beginning, the process of exploring ideas with AI, but do it together as humans to build on those elements.
Yes. And look, of course, there's plenty of places organizationally, reasons, you know, regulated industries and processes and things that hit the public or affect the market like that. You can't be wrong. Mm-hmm. But that control is not new. But for so much of this, it's just internal team collaboration and documents and presentations and sort of basic improvements to our day-to-day work so that we can be more human. In that time that is given back to us by the machine, like there's going to be mistakes. And I think it's okay if we set people up that those will happen and we can go through it together.
Yeah, that's so key, right? Like the ability for a lot of companies now to almost have like mini enterprises or mini like startup type environments to be able to have the opportunity to explore and potentially fail. Right. And then get better through that learning. That's also so critical. So let's talk a little bit about the future proofing of organizations over the next decade. Right. If you were to design the ideal workplace for the next decade, what elements would need to be included to foster productivity, collaboration, and well-being?
Yeah, I think so. We're talking about like what is the future physical environment to support the future organization, right? Mm-hmm. I believe, and let's just stick with kind of the generalized knowledge worker set for a moment, that the future organization is going to become more sort of networks of teams and portfolios of assignments and gigs happening, whether that's by full-time employees serving multiple internal masters and resources or external gig and freelance and independent workers who are coming in and out of your ecosystem very quickly. All of it will become sort of more fluid, more agile, and therefore slightly less predictable. And back to the earlier point, like offices today tend to be only mediocre when, you know, dealing with an organization that's fairly traditional and static. Boxes, lines, pyramids, you know, headcount and resource planning. People are where you sort of think they're going to be, at least for a reasonable amount of time. And even then, the performance of the space is not that high. And people like me for years have been trying to usher us into a world of greater mobility and sharing in the environments that we control. The only real way to go from everybody saying that, this desk or this office that I sit in, that is like a BB plus at best for most of the things that I do. The only way to solve that problem is to untether them from that space and give them access to a diverse range of work settings around their environment. And it's easy to say, right? Oh, welcome to the office today. It's still your office. Everybody here works with you and for you, same company. It's all private. But if you've got to get your head down, you've got a quiet space to go to. If you're feeling really social, you can be in a social and hospitality-oriented space. If you've got to work on some very deliberate project for a while, we've got team rooms, all these different things. That is not new. But the adoption is still very low. And I worry in particular that in this post-COVID world where a lot of leaders are saying, I want you here more, that we're starting to see some of them dangling assigned and personalized and therefore static spaces as a carrot. If you come back, I'm going to give you that thing you used to have years ago, a big office or a desk that's all yours. Don't worry about it. But that is going against the kind of the future of the organization itself being more fluid. So because individual spaces, no matter how hard we try, technically, built environments are still hard to change. So the answer, I think, will be not really that different from the idea of diverse ranges of highly technically enabled, engaging network, community, and hospitality-powered spaces. But you have to give and encourage individuals and teams the ability to move throughout those environments and even piercing out of your own private space and prioritizing individual and team mobility, the willingness to go, oh, we were over there yesterday, we're going to be over here today. Not just for efficiency of real estate to say, I want to take up less space, or I want you to share just for the fun of it. But I'm giving you or asking you to take the flexibility to seek opportunity by going to spaces that were purpose-built for the thing you've got to do now. We do this in our personal lives all the time. We choose different hotel brands, hotel rooms, restaurants, events that we go to for fun. And in work, it cannot just be static and hyper-personalized in the way that it was if you want to take advantage of this fluidity with team sizes and makeup and projects like coming and going in a much more rapid pace. So for that reason, I'm very bullish on the continued growth of community and flexible space providers, co-working, whatever you want to call it, whether that's individual brands or just the building that your company happens to occupy, having many options for you to go during the day. But the employees have to be told and leaders have to role model that mobility, being able to move, will let us constantly be matching the supply and demand of the kinds of spaces that we need to do the things that we need to in that moment.
Yeah, that's important. Like what you're ultimately sharing is having that flexibility, right? So really a lot of the future is being very aware of the different types of needs that the workforce is going to have. From a requirement standpoint.
Right. We can't change the spaces very quickly, but we can change people's journeys. That will come with some friction and some cognitive load, but that again will be more possible with AI and little, team co-pilots so that you and I can both be told, look, today you have to do that thing. You've got that meeting. Go to the fifth floor, go to the blue zone. It's been sorted. It's booked for you. The thing is there that you need. Took care of all that for you. Just go. And you go, and it's great.
That would be very cool, right?
That is the only way to make it possible, this vision that I have. But it sort of happens in our personal life. It's sort of starting in our personal life, right? Netflix knows you watch one thing, you might like something else. It's this kind of nudge tech that we need that can direct physical spaces and teams on the ground to prepare them in the way that they need to help you be successful.
Yeah, I like that. The nudge tech. You're right. I was hearing of the nudge tech also on the Gartner report, right? That Gartner yes. recently came out with. They were speaking of that. So we're nearing the tail end of our conversation, Phil. I'd love to be able to understand, you know, if we roll back time and we look at Phil in his early 20s, in your early 20s, if you can give yourself one piece of advice, what would it be?
I mean, I started my career actually in information security, which was really fascinating, put me very close to multiple lines of businesses and sort of business process and architecture. And I am someone who very much likes to see the system, so to speak. But it wasn't until my sort of second career before falling into workplace and employee experience where I am now, where I fell into cost management and efficiency that put me closer to like the numbers of the business, mm-hmm. which just in hindsight, like for my career, and I see a lot of people going into IT or real estate or HR roles in this world that I live in who are a click or two removed from the money and the numbers of the business, even if not required for their, you know, for their day-to-day job to either make sure that that's something that is in their development plan, make sure it's something that they're asking of their leaders so that they can truly understand the impact of what it is that they're doing, how internal and external clients are charged for the impact of what they're doing, and just a different mentality about the outcomes and impacts of your work when you can see that. Not every role in the large organization needs it, but I would tell my 22-year-old self to go and seek it out if it's not right in front of you every day.
Wow. Okay. Thank you so much, Phil. This has been really, really engaging and informative. You're such a wealth of knowledge, and it feels like you've lived a few lives, right, in your career, right? So we appreciate you taking the time today on behalf of the Employee Wellbeing Council. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for joining us on the Wellbeing Ignites Well Doing podcast, brought to you by OOT Social Health. We hope today's conversation has sparked new insights and inspired you to prioritize well-being in your journey to organizational success. Remember, when well-being ignites, well-doing follows. Stay tuned for more episodes as we continue to explore the power of human-centric leadership. Until then, be well and lead with purpose.